He shut the door behind him. "Well, if that don't beat all," Leeson said, whistling loudly. "I'd never counted on you as a squid tamer, Harris. Will wonders never cease?" Harris turned him a venomous glance, and Leeson grinned back. Then he sauntered away to his end of the module with his head held high. "That prick," Harris muttered to me, "he's loving it. We got all the shit work, and he's sitting pretty." "Shall I kill him, adjunct?" Silt said, looming near. Harris looked up in surprise. "Well, no. We don't do that sort of thing, normally, in this outfit."
"My mistake," the squid said. "On my homeworld, when two officers disagree, one of them must be defeated by the other before there is resolution. Servitude or death. There is no other possibility."
"There's cooperation," I said, speaking up, "for the mutual survival of all." Silt made a rumbling sound. He could have been laughing, coughing, or shitting himself. It was hard to tell with a squid. After the newcomers were given quarters, as far from the rest of the troops as possible, we spent an uneasy night with them. I don't know about the rest of the officers, but I could hardly sleep, knowing the enemy was snoring nearby. Chapter 11. Integration was the goal, but it didn't come easily. Bloodworlders were near humans, but we soon found our new soldiers had a very different mindset. "All right, third unit," Winslade began, marching in front of us with his hands clasped behind his back, his long-fingered right hand clutched at his skinny left wrist. For some reason, I found this distasteful, but I tried to overlook it.
"Today, we're going to start with target practice. Our new friends will be introduced to non-traditional weaponry. Non-traditional for them, that is."
So saying, he gave each of the heavy troopers a belcher. They looked at them like they'd been given toilet brushes. One man even looked into the barrel with a huge bloodshot eye.
"No, no, no," Sargon said, shouldering forward. He was about the biggest man in the unit, not as tall as me, but bulkier.
He snatched away the belcher and earned himself a scowl. The man he'd disarmed reached forward to snatch the belcher back, but halted. I noticed that the squid non-com, Silt, made a fluttering gesture with one tentacle. The heavy trooper froze, then dropped his hand. He sulked motionlessly. Silt used hand gestures to command the littermates? I might have to learn those.
"You see here, dumbass," Sargon began, "this is the reticle. You're looking out the wrong end. You'll burn your fool head off doing that."
Sargon proceeded in his usual brusque fashion to educate the hulking near humans on the proper use of the belcher. They learned slowly but methodically. They appeared to be teachable. That's when I turned to my fresh-faced squad of human kids. I twisted my lips up into an expression of disgust. "This is where we take our leave," I told them. "Follow me." They did so, and I was glad they were too scared to ask any questions. I didn't like to lie. Not on a day like today. We walked out of the main chamber of Green Deck, which by day served us as an exercise yard and by night as a social haven. We walked the long, long way around to the far side, and we waited at a pair of huge power doors.
"Don't these doors lead into the main room again?"
asked a snotty voice. My head snapped up. There he was. Cooper. He'd been quiet up until now. He'd stayed low. But a young man like him could only fake it for so long. His real personality was bound to emerge over time, as certain as the sun rising in the east.
"That's right," I told him.
"Then why are we wasting time, sir?"
There was just a little hint of a sneer in that last word. I could hear it. Maybe not everyone could, but I did, and that was good enough. I gave him a grin, which made him frown back. We're waiting until that light goes on. Right up there. I pointed to a big light over the top of the power doors. Cooper shut up, but I could see that not knowing the score was eating at him. Strange setup, one of Cooper's squad mates said. Retarded is a form of strange, I guess, Cooper agreed. My veteran glowered at them, then glanced at me. She was a stocky fireplug of a woman named Mahler. I shook my head just a fraction. Nope, it wasn't time to bust heads. Not yet. Another minute slid by, and all my snot-nosed splats began shifting restlessly. Finally, the light went green. I slammed my hands together loudly. Okay, platoon, we're going in. You'll be issued snap rifles. Listen close to veteran Mahler. She'll teach you how to use them. About frigging time, Cooper said. The big doors slid open, and we stepped inside. There, right in front of us, were several racks of snap rifles. These light but highly versatile and effective weapons weren't quite like the ballistic weapons of the past. Instead of using gunpowder to propel their bullets, the snap rifles used tricks of physics to accelerate tiny pellets to fantastic speeds. Any object sped up to around 5,000 miles an hour tended to do two things, burn up and hit hard. The bullets were often made with alloys, including metals like tungsten, which had a melting temperature of well over 3,000 degrees Celsius. The size of the projectile didn't matter that much, as the kinetic force upon impact was tremendous anyway. The rifles had a high rate of fire and could hold about 1,000 rounds of ammo in their auto-fed magazines. This meant troops didn't have to worry about reloading much, and they could hit targets at long range with little drop-off due to gravity and wind resistance. After a brief lecture outlining these points, I handed off the distribution of the weapons to veteran Mahler. She issued each soldier a gun and made sure they could hold it right. Now, I said, you see those targets over there? They followed my gesture, and Cooper laughed. All I see are trees, he said. Right. Hit them. Take them down. The troops looked at me in confusion, but Cooper grinned. He aimed his gun and released a loud hammering spray of rounds. The weapon kicked up, but he didn't lose control. He took a firm stance and grip. He set his feet, put his eye to the sights, and fired away in short, controlled bursts. The tree he was aiming at spit white wood. The trunk was soon torn up and leaves fluttered. This is great, Cooper laughed. The others soon joined in, and Mahler walked the line, adjusting grips and kicking feet wider apart. Soon they were all blazing away, and the first tree came crashing down. The squad cheered, and I smiled grimly. It was their first accomplishment. Are we damaging Green Deck, sir? One of the girls asked me. I shrugged. It grows back fast, don't worry about it. The trees were, in fact, genetically designed to sprout up like mushrooms. The wood was thin and light, and it would crack if you punched it hard enough. But by the next day, it would grow back again. The team was all smiles at that point. But the mood didn't last long. A beam sprang out of the tree line to our left, a bluish radiance that was ghostly and liquid in nature. It struck three of the recruits. They went up in flames, screaming. They fell and writhed on the deck. Incoming fire, I roared. Take cover! They threw themselves onto the ground, except the two slowest. They were crisped next. Spread out! Return fire! I can't see them, Cooper shouted. They're behind the trees and rocks. I began laying down suppressive fire, chipping each of the trees and sparking rounds on the rocks. I had to get the enemy to duck before my whole command was taken out. Most of the recruits hammered away, shooting ghosts. But Cooper held his fire. He wasn't scared, not more than usual anyway. He seemed to have a plan. Movement appeared to our right. Cooper was on it like an angry wasp. He fired short bursts, hard-hitting and accurate enough at this range, which was maybe 50 meters. A heavy trooper toppled back, but then got up again, hugging his rock. More blue beams lanced out at us, and we returned fire.
"It's those freaks!" a recruit shouted. "They've turned on us, sir. I knew they would."
"That's right," I said. "Take them down."
Cooper stood up and charged. Two beams tried to catch him, but the kid was fast, and the enemy barely knew how to handle their weapons. They had their belchers dialed up too tightly. Hell, if they'd opened the apertures just halfway, they'd have burned us all down in that first barrage.
Cooper made it to the rock where he'd hit the first blood worlder. Standing on top of it, he hammered away point blank, putting 100 rounds through a near human's faceplate. The troopers sagged down, stone dead. That's when things went off script. The troopers, seeing one of their littermates brought low, went berserk. They stood up in unison, roaring with impossibly low voices. They charged us, and we blazed away at them, bringing down 2, then 3 more. But that was it. The troopers were berserk. They used their belchers as clubs as often as they fired them, clubbing the crawling recruits like seals on a beach. They put us down. All of us. Mahler and I managed to take out one more with our knives before we, too, were beaten to death. Chapter 12. I was revived and dumped into the cold, waiting arms of an orderly. Before I could see straight, I was hustled off blue deck and into nostrums, echoing passages. I didn't mind, it was all part of the job.
"Adjunct McGill?" a voice called after me as I staggered toward 3rd Unit's assigned module. Turning around, I nodded to Cooper.
"Did you just pop out of the oven?" I asked him.
"No, sir. I was one of the first to die, so they processed me about an hour ago. I've been waiting for you to walk down this passage."
Warily, I slowed, and we walked alongside one another. I took my time to fully appraise him. Back in my day, I'd killed veteran Harris for slaughtering my fellow recruits. Cooper might be that kind of renegade as well. But I didn't see murder in his eyes, and he had no weapon. Instead, he was looking at me with honest curiosity.
"What did you want to say, recruit?" I asked him.
"Well, sir, I realized that whole thing was a setup. I read up on Varus training techniques months ago. I was kind of expecting it, in fact. Not so soon, though. I thought it would happen after we got our first week's weapons training."
"Is that what you wanted to know, why we moved ahead so fast?" He eyed me curiously.
"No, I get all that. What I want to know is why you fought with us."
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"I would have expected an officer to step back out of the line of fire, to send all us chumps to the grinder. I mean, you knew it was coming, right?"
"Of course."
"So why did you play it to the end? Why'd you actually die with us?"
I shrugged. "It's all part of the job. Dying isn't fun, but you get used to it." The kid's mouth hung open. He shook his head slowly.
"I don't know. I don't know if I can ever get used to it."
"Some can't," I admitted. "They usually bug out and join the hogs. Life and death both come hard and fast for a bona fide starman. Not everyone can take it." We'd stopped walking, but at this point I moved on. I left him there to ponder in confusion. As I rounded the next corner, I glanced back once. Cooper was still standing there. He was leaning his back against a wall, staring up at the ceiling. I could tell he was thinking hard. That made me smile. The kid had gotten his bell rung today. Time would tell if he was a real Legion Varus man or not. I couldn't make that transition happen. I could only facilitate. When I got to the unit module, the mood was more than glum. All the regular recruits had checked in by dinner time. But not the blood worlders. The heavy troopers who died in the firefight were wandering back in very slowly from blue deck, one at a time. They glowered at me and my snap rifle men with hate. Harris and Silt were walking among them, explaining that no one had died, not permanently, and that this process was all part of their training. I could tell the blood worlders were having a hard time swallowing it all. Dinner time came and went, and I noted less than half of the heavy troopers were back yet. "Harris," I asked, "what's the hold-up with your new boys?"
"I'll be damned if I know," he complained. "I've half a mind to go down there and kick ass. These heavy troopers are still suspicious of the whole process. I need them back here now, so they'll stop trading rumors."
I looked around for Winsley, but he was hiding in his quarters again. "I'll go check it out," I told Harris. "Keep the lid on up here with Silt." Harris frowned at me.
"You don't give me orders anymore, McGill."
"Okay, fine, I'll just go watch a vid show and catch a nap."
All right, never mind, I'm just annoyed. I'd appreciate the help."
Marching down to Blue Deck, I was met with unpleasant expressions. "What are you doing down here, adjunct?" one non-com had the balls to ask. "Are you lost, or maybe you'd like to take another ride on the gurney?" I glowered at him, and he melted. Sometimes freshly revived troops, even officers, came back with vengeance on their minds. "I'm here to check up on the slow revives. What's the holdup?"
"Slow?
Oh, you must be talking about those fat bastards from Blood World, right?" I nodded.
"Yeah. They're not being revived with the rest. They've got their own ward down the hall."
He directed me, and I marched down a long passage to the very end. Hardly anyone was around down here, just a few orderlies and a single, large door. I ignored the restricted access signs, pushing it open and walking inside. There, I was in for a new shock. A massive revival machine, three times the size of any I'd ever seen, hulked in one corner. It took up at least a quarter of the floor space. Revival machines are a little sickening to begin with. They've got a metal encasement on the front with a control panel merged with the fleshy part. But the part that did all the 3D printing of cells, that part looked like a massive slab of meat with a skin of mottled gray. There were tanks to charge the machine, and this one had the biggest cylinders of protoplasm and bone meal I'd ever seen. The maw was hanging open and dripping, just like normal. But it was gargantuan. A dinosaur's mouth had never existed that could rival it. Except for being bigger, grosser, and smellier, none of this was all that shocking. In fact, it made a perfect kind of sense once I'd laid eyes on it. The heavy troopers were simply too big for traditional machines. They had to have their own unit, and this was it. The real shocker came when I saw who was running the outsized unit. There were three Saurians in the chamber. They looked at me when I opened the door, and we had ourselves a mutual stare down.
"Who are you?"
demanded the nearest of them. At his throat I saw a flashing translator. I knew that device well. Florimel had given one to Rosh, that murdering alien back on Earth. It was new tech, I realized, and this was the newly assigned post for the Saurians Turov had paraded for us after we left Earth. "I'm Adjunct McGill. I lost several heavy troopers today. Why is it taking so friggin' long to revive them?" The Saurians shrugged.
"They're big," the leader said. "As big as our juggers. That's why we were hired to work here."
Suddenly I got it. The Legion had wanted a method of bringing back heavy troopers, but new revival machines, especially big ones, cost a lot. They also had to be manned by a team of bio people who could lift a ton together. These three looked like they fit the bill. Each was as strong and powerfully built as Rosh had been. Also, I recalled that back on my last trip to Steel World, the Saurians had tried to match our revival units with some of their own. They'd revived juggers, members of a huge sub-race that were the size of draft horses. I'd never really thought about it before, but they must have had a really big revival machine somewhere, and a team that could operate it.
"I see," I said. "Is this the only big unit? The only one that can spit out a heavy trooper?"
Yes, it's the only such organism aboard Nostrum.
Cheap bastards, I muttered.
What was that? You insult us?
No, I'm insulting the top officers. They didn't want to pay for enough machines, or enough bioteams like you guys to run them.
The Saurians exchanged glances.
We do not believe you insulted us with your odd statements, but you must go now. We're recharging to start the process again.
As I watched, the maw slowly closed. They poured in fluids and powders, and the machine shivered and began to steam and drip. It seemed to stink a lot, too, even more than they usually did. Wrinkling my nose, I decided to exit the place in a hurry. My troopers would come back eventually, but not as fast as I wanted them to. Chapter 13. The long, long journey through space to our destination star took several weeks. It would have taken months, but Nostrum was a fast ship. She was a new, sleek design that fit humans better than our previous rented-out models had ever done. Most of the passages and public chambers had a ceiling or a wall that appeared to show the cosmos as we passed by it all. It was nice to watch the stars slide by. On a long trip, it made you feel like you were going somewhere fast. Other than this simulated starscape, there was no sensation of movement at all inside our warp bubble. We continued to have training sessions, and I came to respect the heavy troopers. For one thing, they didn't complain all the time. None of them were like Cooper, a maverick with a sneering expression and loud mouth. Instead, they hunkered down and endured whatever abuse our legion chose to throw at them. Those that died were brought back, and that simple fact began to calm the littermates. They didn't go quite as mad anymore whenever a brother fell because they knew the loss wasn't permanent. That was a big relief for the rest of us. Silt, however, that cephalopod was another thing entirely. He began grating on my nerves more and more as the journey came to an end.
Your slaves have failed again,
he informed me after a bloody exercise on Green Deck.
They are clearly inferior.
This time, we'd thrown the recruits into the jungle to attack 9 entrenched giants. The recruits had served as targets primarily. We'd retreated and called the battle a loss when over half the light troopers had been lost without a single heavy being taken out. My eye met Silt, and he rustled his elephant trunk limbs idly.
"Why are you staring at me?"
he asked.
"Have you no words? Can your shame be so tremendous, human?"
"I've been wondering," I said, "if you would fit into that big new revival machine they've got downstairs."
"Why would you ponder such a thing?"
"Well, you know, you're part of this unit, too. I wouldn't want to lose you the moment we arrive on a new planet, but if I do, I would want you to be revived."
"Why would such a thing happen?"
"There are 1,000 ways to die in a ground campaign, Squid. How many times have you invaded a planet, by the way?" Silt thrashed his limbs around and stared at me.
"You know I've never been deployed in actual battle."
"Oh, yeah," I said. "I must have forgotten."
"It seems unlikely that you would require so many reminders."
"Sorry about that, but I'm going to have to ask the Saurian orderlies down on Blue Deck about this. They might even want to measure your carcass, just to make sure they've got the right materials and the unit is big enough for your kind. You understand?"
"Did you mention Saurians?"
"Yep, we hired Saurians from Steel World to operate our new, larger revival units."
"Steel World, Cancri 9. That world has not been subjugated by humans."
"Nope, it sure hasn't. They don't even like us very much in that star system."
"Trusting such beings to raise your dead, that seems foolhardy."
Smiling, I spread my hands wide and shook my head. "I agree. I don't trust those scaly, long-tailed lizards at all.
Then why would the top officers?
What can you do? I said, laughing. They probably work cheap. We're all here to die over and over again on a strange planet. We're supposed to come back to life, but who knows? I guess we'll find out if the lizards know about cephalopod biology one of these days.
Your words are almost threatening.
What? No, not at all. I'm thinking of your welfare, that's all. It's an officer's job to predict problems and prepare to meet challenges. For that reason, I'm thinking I should assign a veteran like Sargon to shadow you as you deal with the Blood Worlders. If you're dead and gone for an extended period, he can step in to fill your role. Silt didn't appear to like that idea. After a moment's pause, he spoke up.
That seems unnecessary.
On the contrary, it's very necessary. Just imagine the scene. We land the Legion, go into combat, and boom! You're squid meat within 5 minutes. Who handles the big guys while our lizards are back aboard the ship reading the manual? Who knows if they can even get a good grow? Might take them 7 or 8 tries, pushing each failure into the grinder to start over.
What's this grinder you speak of?
I explained how a bad grow might come out deformed and require recycling. The wood chipper device they used to reclaim their failures got some loving details. I painted the most vivid picture I could for him.
I'm dissatisfied with these possibilities,
Silt said at last. Oh, now don't turn coward-like on me. I've always heard your race feared nothing.
You heard correctly.
Good then. We land in 2 days from what I hear. No more waiting around aboard this dull ship bored out of our minds. Time to kill and be killed.
Disgruntled, Silt retreated into his humid chambers to sulk.
Ha ha! A familiar laugh burst out behind me when Silt was gone. It was Leeson, and he looked like he'd been listening in. That was priceless, McGill. Old Silt is going to ink his bed tonight with nightmares for sure.
I hope he does, I admitted.
The next day, Nostrum came out of warp. Everyone watched the walls and the ceiling. We were glued to the visuals. The warp bubble dissipated like torn cobwebs, pulling away in a manner that was both alarming and beautiful to behold. The imagery darkened as it went from simulated to real. Dead ahead of our ship was a glimmering brown dwarf. It was a deep, orangey-brown star with stripes on it that almost looked like Jupiter might if you lit the whole thing on fire. It was small but dense, and it burned so faintly it barely looked like a sun at all. It reminded me of a dying coal in a campfire, rather than a stellar body.
That's gotta be the dinkiest excuse for a star I've ever laid eyes on,
Leeson complained.
Better break out the jackets, troops. I'm predicting snow and sleet.
A general groan went up from the unit's rank and file. We were all taken by surprise, as very little had been explained to us in briefings about the exact nature of our destination.
Wait a minute, I said aloud. Is this the right star? I thought we were going to 39 Eridani. That system is supposed to have 2 good-sized stars in a binary system.
Winslade looked at me and he shrugged.
It would seem they lied to us.
But why? I complained. They made such a big deal out of telling us what the target was, then arresting Toro and that other guy afterward for leaking it. How could they—
Turn that simian brain of yours back on, McGill,
Winslade said.
It's counterintelligence, trickery, deceit, whatever you want to call it. You tell your team something very important, but the information is a lie. When that particular lie shows up in a transmission, you can trace the leak directly to its source.
Huh, I said. Diabolical. So this sparkler is it? I can't even see any planets.
They're out there in the dark, somewhere,
Winslade assured me.
We're supposed to land in the morning.
This whole invasion felt wrong somehow. We hadn't been equipped with proper cold weather gear. We'd have to stay in our pressure suits just to stay warm. The whole thing looked bleak. Harris came up to stand beside me. More shit. We always fed shit and kept in the dark in this legion. Seems that way, I admitted. The unit broke up soon thereafter for equipment checks. With deployment in the morning, we had to repack everything and check every seal on our suits. I was especially concerned about my new people. Light troops didn't get any armor, just a tough, layered spacesuit that wasn't all that different from the ones that men had first used to spacewalk and explore on Mars. As an officer, I got a breastplate, at least. It protected my vitals without restricting my movements. But to me, it wasn't good enough. After years of serving in heavy armor, the idea of landing on a hostile world in what amounted to a leathery balloon filled with hot air held no appeal for me. I felt naked. But I didn't let on. "Snap rifle inspection," I shouted, and Veteran Mahler went into action. She marched the ragged line of recruits, kicking ass and screaming into people's faces. It was time to become harsh now. There was no room for screw-ups on a drop, especially a drop into the total unknown. My helmet cracked with an incoming call as I watched Mahler work.
"Varus officers," Turov's voice spoke in my ears. "We have a surprise for you. The destination we described to you at the kickoff briefing has been changed."
"No shit," Harris whispered to himself. We were both on the command channel, which only allowed officers to tune in. As adjuncts, we weren't expected to talk, just to listen.
"Our target is not 39 Eridani, not exactly. It's a brown dwarf nearby. By the star catalog, it's been listed as 191 Eridani."
There were more muttered comments from the officers around me. None of them seemed to appreciate being left out of the loop.
"Some of you, particularly those of limited intellect, might be wondering why Central saw fit to lie about our target. That should now be obvious. This has always been a highly secretive mission. Any public release of our goals could jeopardize the entire venture. For similar reasons, only a single legion has been dispatched to conquer the target planet."
At this, Leeson, Harris, and I exchanged alarmed glances. We'd been under the impression the place was all but abandoned, waiting for Earth forces to land and snap it up. Perhaps that was a lie, too.
191 Eridani is between Earth and Rigel, Turov continued. A zone where our rivals infest many stars. We must gain control of this middle ground between our two growing domains. It's a frontier region not only for Earth, but for the Empire as well.
I couldn't even look at Harris any longer. He hated surprises. His face was so full of contorted expressions, showing in turns rage, disgust, and resignation, that I found it distracting.
"I'm told the target planet has a lot of geological activity, and therefore isn't as cold as one might assume. It is, however, dimly lit during both day and night."
Already we were charging our kits. We had night gear, of course, but a permanently dark world? That would require some special outfitting. I relayed the information to Mahler, who immediately set the troops to rummaging in the equipment lockers.
"We will be landing on the factory superstructure at the end of the shift. No immediate resistance is expected, but the enemy might be able to mount a counterattack in time. It is essential we spread out and gain control of the space dock within a few hours after dropping. Legion Varus forever. Turov out."
She cut the feed, and we three adjuncts looked at each other. "Did you hear that sign off?" Leeson complained. "What kind of pep talk was that? She sounded bored with the whole thing." "Who cares about that?" Harris asked. "She said we're dropping on a factory? An active space dock? Are you shitting me? Who are they building ships for? Where are those ships?
How is Nostrum supposed to invade a space dock that's active and presumably armed?
Huh, I said, firmly believing Harris had a point. This whole thing doesn't feel well planned.
That is the understatement of the 22nd century, McGill, Harris said. I smell a meat grinder. Blue Deck is going to get a workout, mark my words.
Walking away, I went to Winslade. He flicked his finger at me and sighed.
Have a little faith, adjunct, he said. I'm sure they're planning something incredible up there on Gold Deck.
I heard a hint of hurt pride in that statement. After all, a few months ago, Winslade had a higher rank and a choice spot at a desk up there on Gold Deck. Down here in the modules, or dungeons, as the troops called them, we were clueless and confused.
I'm going upstairs, I said. Any objections, sir?
He looked at me seriously for the first time. After considering it, he shook his head.
Who are you going to pester, Primus Graves or the Tribune herself?
Either one. I was kind of hoping you'd give me an excuse, sir. Winslade shrugged.
I've got no pretext to go where I'm not welcome. I'm already slumming it down here, and I don't want to see a further demotion. Of course, I realize such thoughts have never stopped you.
No, sir. But maybe I can give you something to help us both out. Then I told him about our single revival machine, capable of spitting out squids and heavy troopers.
Are you certain?
He asked incredulously.
Absolutely, sir.
That's quite an oversight.
Not at all. It's sheer cheapness. The Legion was given these new troops, but they shorted us the equipment we need to properly support them in the field. The first hard battle, we might lose half of them and wait a week to get them all back out of that machine.
Yes, he said thoughtfully. All right. You can inquire about the slow revival rate of the alien troops, and how we're expected to adjust to the consequently slow trickle of reinforcements we're predicting. Just don't use my name unless asked directly.
Got it. Thank you, Centurion. He dismissed me, and I hustled to the elevators before he could change his mind. Chapter 14. At the lobby in Gold Deck, I expected to be challenged. And I was.
Adjunct McGill, asked a non-smiling veteran.
State your business, sir.
I'm here to see the Tribune, if she'll talk to me. Centurion Winslade sent me.
Huh. The veteran grunted, paging through a contact list on his tapper.
He shrugged. Nothing here about you having an appointment, but there's nothing about you being banned either. Her office is at the end of the passage. Good luck.
When I got to the last door, I figured out why he'd wished me luck. There were six other guys in line ahead of me, and that was just to get past the first door. Groaning aloud, I almost ditched the whole thing right then and there. However, an attractive young adjunct stepped up to me before I could do an about-face. She asked me my name and business. I stated these as I had before. She tapped them in, scanned some results, and raised her eyebrows. She looked up at me in surprise. To be honest, I figured I'd popped up on the no way list. But that wasn't it.
This way, adjunct,
she said. With a surprised smile, I followed her. I had to crowd past the people standing in line.
Hey, a centurion complained. Why is McGill moving up? I've got an appointment, and I've been standing out here for 45 minutes.
McGill has a priority appointment, the adjunct said.
You'll get your turn, I told him. In time, all things come to a patient man. He glared at me and I gave him a smile and nod as I slid past. When we got into the outer office, which had been redecorated since the days of Deitch, I noticed there was no one else waiting there. The adjunct pre-screener dropped me off and I watched her go back out.
James McGill? The secretary asked.
There was a sneer in that voice, and I turned to look at him. I recognized him immediately. He was that same pretty boy who'd been posted outside Galena's office back on Earth.
That's right. Should I take a seat?
He set his mouth in a disgusted expression.
No. Go on in.
Isn't she with someone else?
He shook his head and pointed at the door.
Shrugging, I straight-armed the door, and it swung wide. Turov's office was full of wispy curtains, incense, and expensive-looking art. Head-and-shoulder statues of various hegemony leaders were posed in alcoves with lights shining down on them. Galena herself wasn't in sight, so I figured she must be in the bathroom. She always had an office with a private bathroom. Rank did have its privileges. I walked over to check out the various statues, and I took snapshots of the plaques with my tapper. I figured she was displaying the likeness of people who had been her supporters. Researching their names might teach me a thing or two.
"I see you're admiring my art collection," Galena stated suddenly.
She'd popped up behind me. I turned around, a little confused. I hadn't seen her come out of the bathroom. Did that mean she had a secret passage in here somewhere? I wasn't sure.
Yes, I said. I think I recognize some of these guys.
She was out of uniform. Way out. She wore nothing but a slinky one-piece with lots of sparkles on it.
"Is that why you came here?"
she asked, stepping close and touching my chest with one finger.
"To admire my busts?"
"Your what? Oh, no, Winslade sent me." For some reason, this threw her into a small fit. I wasn't the best at figuring out the motivations of moody women, but this behavior was strange, even for her.
"You mean to tell me you skipped ahead 6 places in line to complain about your new recruits?"
No, sir, not exactly. But we've noticed there's only one revival machine aboard that can support the Blood Worlders. What happens when we get into a serious fight?" She laughed at me and shook her head.
"Can you really be so naive?"
She put a hand out and touched my chest plate. I thought that was odd. Her mood had shifted again.
"This foolishness makes you seem cute to me. I'm almost willing to forgive your rudeness."
As a man who constantly needs to be forgiven, I didn't want to blow any opportunity. "Thanks," I said in a neutral tone, even though I wasn't exactly sure what she was forgiving.
"But can you just tell me what the plan is with the Blood Worlders? These new machines are slow. If we lose 1,000 of them, it will take weeks to get them all back."
Galena sucked in a breath and sighed.
"Think, James,"
she said.
"You were involved in taking Blood World. You saw their vast armies firsthand."
"Yeah," I said, wrinkling my nose at the memory of watching thousands of the brutes march by. I can remember the smell, too.
"The point is, they're great in number. We'll make up for our losses with fresh troops, rather than bothering to revive them all. It's much cheaper."
I blinked at that. But slowly I got the message.
"Seriously? We're going to let them get permed?"
"Throughout history, troops have normally died once. You do realize that, don't you?"
"Yeah, but it seems wrong, knowing that I'm going to be brought back and they aren't."
"Yes, that's why it's your job as the officer in the field to make sure they don't die.
But how are we going to get replacements out here? They're all back on Earth, or home on Blood World." She pointed a finger at me.
"Keep thinking. You're doing so well. I can almost see the smoke coming out of your ears."
Are we going to use the gateway posts to walk them through when we need them?
Ha! You've got it. The gateway will be set up in a separate module. When men die, they will be replaced.
But how can I train new people all the time? I asked.
That part is inefficient,
she admitted.
What we're doing in secret is sending back vids of the training you and other officers are providing. Back on Earth, in their base camps, teams are training with the Iron Eagles. They will come through knowing what is expected of them.
My confused stare transformed into a solid frown. The more I heard about this scheme, the less I liked it. They'd turned the Blood Worlders into second-class troops. It didn't seem fair, and it didn't seem like it would work very well either.
Are you finished asking dumb questions?
She asked. Yeah, I guess so. But I didn't like the answers much.
Do you even know why I was angry when you first arrived?
No, not entirely, I admitted. She sighed and clucked her tongue.
Do you remember the last time we were together in my office?
Sure.
You understand that it was an embarrassing moment for me, right?
Of course.
Now, what was I supposed to do if I wanted to see you again?
Send me a message? She shook her head. Her voice took on a tone that was like that of a lady talking to a dumb kid who just wasn't getting it. I'd heard that tone before plenty of times.
I'm under investigation for harassment, remember?
She asked. Oh, sure. I remember something about that. From Winslade.
There you go. So, how would it look if there was a trail of online communications between me and you, initiated by me?
Bad, I admitted, and finally I was starting to catch on. Galena had been avoiding me like the plague. I'd figured that was because she was embarrassed or angry about something, but that wasn't it. She'd been covering her shapely ass all along. She dropped me because of Winslade's legal challenges, not because she wasn't interested. Suddenly, a whole bunch of things made more sense to me. Smiling at last, I encircled her with my arms.
You're doing this of your own free will, aren't you?
She asked me. Damn straight.
Good,
she said, and she kissed me. Her lips were buttery soft. Then, she pushed a button on her tapper and she slid out of my grasp.
That's good enough,
she said, her tone suddenly businesslike. She walked back behind her desk while I stared after her, dumbfounded all over again. What the hell? Galena was staring down at her desk intently. She brought up a window and began pecking it with her fine fingers. She made a shooing motion with her other hand.
Dismissed.
Hold on a minute, I said. This is bullshit. You just wanted to get me to say that? You recorded the whole thing on your tapper, and now you're going to use it as evidence against Winslade, aren't you? She glanced up at me.
Of course. Grow up, McGill. I'm too busy for sex today. Did you see that line out front? Did you seriously think I would be entertaining you in here, in the middle of the afternoon, while a crowd waited outside?
No, I lied. That was exactly what I thought and hoped for after she'd teased me.
Very well, then. Crawl back to that worm Winslade and tell him the good news. His worries about reinforcements are unfounded.
I was mad. She'd tricked me, teased me, and used me. I thought about threatening to testify against her, but I couldn't quite get myself to do it. Heaving a sigh, I gave myself a shake and headed for the door.
James,
she called after me. Yes, Tribune?
You don't have to be a stranger. If you want to see me at a more opportune time, well, I might be more receptive.
I'll think about that.
Exiting the office and the outer office, I again pressed past the gaggle in the passageway. They looked at me with hate in their eyes.
Well, asked the centurion who'd complained to me before, can we go in now?
I glanced around. That little adjunct who'd been playing hostess was nowhere in sight. Maybe she was taking a break now, too.
It'll be a bit, I announced to them loudly. I just finished her daily afternoon rubdown, and so she's relaxing with some nice whale sounds and hot rocks. You know the routine.
They looked at me astounded.
Whale sounds? What are you, her masseur?
Uh-huh.
The centurion shook his head in amazement. No wonder it's taking so damn long to get in there.
Well, now, I admonished him. Don't be rude. You can't rush these things. That will spoil the whole effect. A stress relief session with aromatherapy, a foot massage, and all the rest of it will be spoiled if you let people with petty problems barge in afterward. No, sir. It'll probably be another half hour or so.
Then I walked off toward the elevators. Behind me, I heard them mutter angrily among themselves about Turov. My ears almost stung from all the bad words.
People will say awful things when the object of their scorn is safely out of earshot.
Chapter 15. The next day we arrived at the target planet. There were no defensive barrages fired up at us, so we slid into orbit right on top of the target factory complex, which hung in space a good 400 kilometers above the surface of the world itself. As an officer, I was allowed to access a vid feed from outside the ship. I'd expected to jog aboard a lifter, but that wasn't how they wanted to play it this time.
Troops, I announced to my platoon. We're headed for Red Deck. We're getting into capsules, and we're going to make this drop look picture perfect.
They looked at me, scared. Even Cooper was worried.
But we've never even dropped before, adjunct, he said.
That's right. But fortunately, there's nothing to it. Molly will go first, and I'll bring up the rear, shoving.
Don't you want me to get them loaded into the cannon, sir?
Mahler asked. I glanced at her. She was right. Normally, the non-coms stayed with the troops, slapping the chicken out of any of them that felt like hanging back.
Nope, I said. I want to watch firsthand to see how they perform.
She nodded and didn't complain. I liked that about her. She wasn't full of color and spice, but she got the job done, and she didn't argue all the time. Harris had been more of a smartass, even worse than Sargon. Mahler was strictly business.
Follow the red arrows, she boomed, trotting ahead. They've started flashing. That means we've got 5 minutes before we drop.
For my own part, I was a little excited. We hadn't dropped like this on a world we hadn't mapped out in a long, long time. What's more, I couldn't recall the last time we'd hot-dropped on a satellite structure at all. When we hustled them all up to the tube-like loading bay, we soon had them in a ragged line, each trooper clutched onto their equipment like they were facing execution. Which, by the odds, some of them were.
This is it,
Mahler said, pointing at a round hole in the deck. It was about a meter wide and 6 times as deep. The hole was black, but ran with a few blue lights. Artificial gravity tugged hard on anyone who stepped over the chute, and you could hear a gentle sucking sound. They maintained negative air pressure here to make sure anything and everything they wanted to load got down there in one balled-up mass.
The first chance you'll get to kill yourselves today is right here, Mahler said. You want to step out into the middle of the chute. Don't be grabbing the sides or getting twisted up. You're going to drop down into open space, and 2 halves of a capsule will slam down over you. At that point, if you haven't had an appendage chopped off, you'll be taking a gentle ride down to the target.
I watched the troops. Some of them looked like they were hyperventilating. Others looked like they weren't breathing at all. The sight made me smile, remembering my first drop.
On the way down, you got no control,
I said, stepping in. Just enjoy the ride, and read the data stream if you want to. If you hit the explosive bolts early, you'll splat for sure.
That's your second chance to die, Mahler said. Once you're down and out of your capsule, killing you isn't our job any longer. That's up to the enemy. Any questions?
They were all staring at the hole, mesmerized. The red arrows began blinking in unison, and a klaxon sounded, making all the recruits jump. The hole clamped shut with a powerful blast of released gas.
Okay, watch me,
Mahler said, stepping up to the line. She had to shout now to be heard over all the active machinery.
Timing is critical. After you see me go down, the chute will close. Then the outer hatch will open below. Only one hatch opens at a time, because we don't want to depressurize the whole frigging ship. About once every 3 seconds, this hatch will open and shut again. When it opens, drop in and don't screw up.
As she said these words, the hole shot open again. She stepped neatly out into space and vanished. She fell faster than normal due to the enhanced gravity and the sucking vacuum draw of the loading tube. The hatch sliced closed hard and fast, and we heard something like a cannon firing below.
She's away,
I boomed, stepping up and grabbing the shoulders of the first recruit in line. She was young, female, and terrified. I wondered if I'd have to push. I wanted to make sure she didn't screw up right off. It would be harder to get the rest into the chute if they had to step over a lot of splashy gore. The chute opened, and the girl stepped out into the center just like Mahler had done. She gave a little squeak of fear as she was sucked down into darkness. The doors scissored shut again, and I turned a broad grin to the rest of the platoon.
See that? Nothing to it. This is fun once you get the hang of it.
The next recruit in line was Cooper. He eyed me, and I eyed him. I couldn't help myself. I reached out and grabbed him.
You're next, Cooper, I told him. You're not going to let that girl show you up, are you?
For just a second, he looked at me, and fear sprouted up in his eyes. I was a little too happy, and I grinned a little too broadly. I knew what he had to be asking himself. Was he going to become my first accident of the day? An object lesson for the rest? Watching these paranoid thoughts go through that little shit's mind, I pushed him to the line and held him ready for the hole to open again.
Hands off, sir. I want to do this on my own.
The door fired open, and I lifted my hands away from him. He stepped out into space. But he took a moment too long. I winced. Damn, he'd hesitated. The aerial on top of his helmet, small though it was, had been chopped off by the scissoring doors.
See that? I roared at the rest. Could have been his whole head. Wet your pants if you have to, but you've got to move.
The door popped open again, and the next recruit didn't reject my guidance. There was a rhythm to it, and you had to jump in the moment the doors clanged open. The whole point of processing troops this fast was to get us clumped together for the drop. If we landed on the target as closely together as we could, we'd be able to meet up and fight more quickly. In the end, dropping fast was more important than suffering a few splats along the way. At least, that's how the Legion saw things. My turn came last. I stepped into space, experienced a stomach-lurching drop, and for a split second I saw open space around me. I was in the midst of many dropping soldiers. We were being loaded into capsules and fired out of Nostrum's belly, 32 troops at a time. Out to my sides in my peripheral vision, I saw flashes of stars. Below the firing mechanism, a big gray-brown and acid-green planet spread wide. In between the planet and our ship was a glinting structure of burnished metal. It looked like no one had ever bothered to paint it. Then, everything vanished again. The two halves of a rounded cylinder slammed over me from either side, loading me up like a bullet into a firing chamber. The slamming part had been silent as I was out in open space. It still made me wince. It always did.
Air began to hiss, pressurizing the drop capsule. I could hear again after that, as the capsule was spun around, loaded into a breech, and aimed at the target.